a lot of people here today. That's awesome. If anyone's interested in speaking, we always are looking for speakers, especially lightning talks. I really want someone to give lightning talks. So if that's you, yeah, you, come give a lightning talk. That'd be great. Just a quick refresher, if you're not familiar, lightning talks, about 5 minutes. I won't be super strict on time, but just a brief intro to some concept or idea or application or something that you've been working with. Seems pretty cool to you. I imagine other people would think it's cool to them too. So let me know. You can email geekfest@groupon.com and we can talk about it. If anyone's looking for a job, Groupon's always hiring. It's a lot of fun to work here. We do a lot of cool things at a ridiculous scale. So if that's interesting to you, you can talk to us. There's a bunch of people in this room who work at Groupon as well. We'd all be happy to talk to you about it. If you're looking for the bathrooms, I know sometimes the signs are confusing. It's actually out back towards the elevators, and you'll see signs in the hallway for that. And that should be good to go. So let's welcome Paul. Right, Paul, sorry.
Let's see if this microphone works. It does. I'll try and wander around a little bit because of the pillars.
Hello.
Happy Tuesday. How goes the computering? Tuesday at noon, rainy day? Nods, quiet nods. That sounds about right for a rainy Tuesday. All right. So this talk is called Smoke and Mirrors, the Primitives of High Availability. Let's go. My name is Paul Hinsey. I'm Finzy on the places on the web where you put your name. That's a picture of me when I joined the company that I'm at, HashiCorp. Captures all the emotions that I felt when I joined HashiCorp, which was excited and terrified. I've been there since January. HashiCorp, you may know from their products, most of which are open source. So Vagrant, Packer, Surf, Consul, Terraform, and most recently Vault. And then we have a commercial product that stitches them all together into a smooth workflow, and that's called Atlas. It's the logo for that on the bottom. So I want to start today by talking about abstraction. I start basically every time I talk about technology by talking about abstraction. I think that abstraction is like the undergirding concept of basically everything important that we do in technology. And I think it's the thing that gives us the most power. So let's talk about what abstraction means. It comes from the Latin abstrahere, which is to draw away, which I think is the perfect summary of the way we use abstraction in computer science, which is, don't worry about this, worry about that. Or, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain, just look at that nice, pretty green face. It's enabled us to build this, these different building up layers of abstraction has enabled us to build some pretty impressive things. Case in point, the internet. So in order to get kind of a feel for abstraction, I thought we could do one of my favorite geeky exercises, which is to take a single web request and break down the layers of abstraction, or at least most of the layers of abstraction, to see how much is really in there. I'm going to turn this off because it's getting heavy. I don't know. I'm going to use this. Yes. All right. Let's say you pull up GitHub. And that's most of the way you think about it today, right? You think about pulling up GitHub, and that's it. Like, you pull it up, and there it is. But I think as the people in this room know better than almost anybody, there's way more going on when you quote-unquote pull up GitHub. And so most of the time you don't have to think about this when you're using GitHub. If you're building a site like GitHub or like Groupon, you have to think about some of these layers. But for a minute, let's just think about all of the layers, or at least as many as I've chosen to show you, because you could kind of go to infinity, or at least down to physics. So let's go. So it's not just flat. There's actually kind of a complex layout engine in your browser that's determining the elements and where they're positioned, their size, what goes on top of what goes on top, what goes on the bottom, fonts, colors, animations. And that's what gets composed into what you end up seeing as the website. So how does that layout engine know what to do? Well, it consumes large blobs of text. These are the blobs of text that web developers, that I assume most of you are, or most of us are, or have been web developers. We know these blobs of text very well as HTML, CSS, JavaScript. And these blobs of text, along with assets, get fed into the layout engine in order to tell it what to do. So where does it get the blobs of text? That's the next step. Well, you just have to ask GitHub, right? But there's a lot of complexity in that layer as well. So let's dive in there. So what's GitHub? Well, first of all, it's github.com at the top of the browser, but in reality, it's an IP address. So we have to use the domain name system to look up the IP address for GitHub. There's a lot of complexity in the domain name system that I'm just going to skip over for now. We'll come back to the DNS later. So, okay, so we've got the IP address. What do we say? Well, we use HTTP, a text-based protocol that essentially allows us to request the blob of text that we want, and the browser responds with the blob of text that we want, and then we give it back to the browser. So that's cool. We know what to say, but how do we say it? How do we actually talk to GitHub? Well, we use TCP to establish a tunnel that allows us to exchange text with GitHub on the internet. So the TCP is a persistent connection between your computer and a computer over at GitHub that allows you to exchange blobs of text, which is what we need, it turns out. But there's a problem, which is you're not directly connected to GitHub. So if I'm doing this from Chicago and GitHub servers happen to be in San Francisco, so we wanted to establish this connection, but we can't do it directly. And that's where IP comes in. So how do you actually get from Illinois over to Chicago over to San Francisco using IP? You can actually ask the computer this, which I think is pretty fun. There's a bunch of tools, but one of them is MTR, which I'm pretty sure the M stands for mics, which I think is hilarious. This is the realm of networking tools. You can get away with a really popular tool that's named like mics something. So I did this from my home router or from my home Wi-Fi, and I got 13 hops. It took 13 hops to get from my computer over to GitHub. And if you notice in that fourth hop, it's one of like 8 machines that ended up having to hit on the fourth hop, which is pretty crazy. I GeoIP looked up each of those just to give a feel. So essentially we start in Chicago. We actually bounce over to Virginia for some reason. Two nodes in Virginia, 4 in, Tennessee? And then there's a bunch of kind of like question mark nodes in like Utah and Colorado before we finally get to the GitHub servers. And so the question is, how does it choose this path? Like, this path does not make any sense. Well, it's a series of very simple or comparatively simple decisions that are made by the routers along the way. So each node, each kind of IP address that we're hitting is a router that's speaking internet protocol. And it's receiving a packet from us that's destined for GitHub, that GitHub's IP address. And each router has a routing table. So it's got several connections, and it has to make a decision about which connection to push the packet to. And so it literally goes and looks down the routing table to find the network that is represented by the IP address of the envelope or of the packet. And it says, okay, I guess I'm going to C. And then C is going to do the same process. It's got a routing table, and it's going to look up the same IP address, determine where the next hop is. And that happens really, really quickly over and over again to get like relatively instantaneous experience of pulling up the browser. So, okay, so now each of these routers has a routing table. How does it know which connection is the best connection for a given network? This is where BGP comes in, and I am obsessed with BGP right now. I have 2 slides on BGP, and that's as a benefit to you, because I should have just gone off on BGP. So BGP, Border Gateway Protocol, is the protocol that's spoken between core internet routers. And it's a reachability protocol. So essentially they're exchanging information about the routes that they can see. So the entirety of the internet is broken up into what's called autonomous systems. And autonomous systems is just a shortcut number for, so it's like autonomous system, 4824 is a shortcut for like this network. And then you split the internet up into that list, and then everybody has that entire list. At least the core routers do. And they're exchanging information about who from that list they can see, and cost information. Like, I can see, 4824 in this direction, and it seems like it's about 4 hops away. And you combine that, And they basically just gossip that information out to each other. So these graphs are kind of hard to read, but the idea is on the top one, it's the rate of updates that are going between these core routers at all times. And you can see that, well, you can sort of see that it peaks at above 1,000 per second each hour. So they're just like scattering this information across the internet all the time. And on the bottom, it's the BGP table, the way it changes size. So those are like, the red line is like the relative size changing over the course of like a several day period. You can see it gets like really volatile when something crazy happens on the internet, like a core router goes down or like a backhoe goes through a fiber optic cable somewhere. And the internet has to sort of, like, it's constantly sending out these updates, and then all of a sudden the updates have to change with the way that packets are routed from router to router. So this crazily complex system with its own detail that we're not going to go into, because I would go nuts and you would get really bored, is how each router makes a decision in IP so that a path can be drawn for a packet from one place to another, so that a logical connection can be established between two computers, so that text can be slung back and forth, so that the correct blob of text for a given web page can get fed into a layout engine, so that you can pull up GitHub. So that's the internet, or at least most of it. And so now let's talk about high availability. So there's going to be some relevant pieces here. So I didn't just talk about the internet and abstraction for fun. I also talked about it because each of those layers of abstraction, and basically almost every point of abstraction, is an opportunity for innovation. So in high availability and also kind of everywhere, when you establish a layer of abstraction, you can change out the implementation to your benefit, right? You can do it faster, you can do it better, you can do it, in our case, it's going to be in a way that is more resilient. We'll revisit a couple of those layers as we go through the primitives that I'm collecting here. And we'll talk about which layer of abstraction they take advantage of to do their work. All right. So let's talk about what high availability is. I'll tell you what's not highly available, and it's this. I don't know if your bank does this, but it drives me bonkers. It just basically like goes down for 8 hours at a time on the weekend, seemingly every weekend. And I hope for banks. It seems worse for banks than most. And it's like maybe banks have old technology and they kind of haven't figured out the way to do this. But I hope that it's like financial. Like there's some sort of bookkeeping they have to do. Because if it's technology related, it's absurd the amount of time that my bank goes down. So high availability is like the opposite of this. Like let's not do this to our users. Let's not take maintenance windows that are incredibly long. And let's stay up. And so you'll see these terms kind of together often, which is, high availability is, when you're talking about high availability, you're talking about fault tolerance. When you're talking about fault tolerance, you're talking about resilience. There's sort of different ways of talking about the same thing. But my favorite way of thinking about fault tolerance is battling chaos, because that's essentially what you're doing. It's how do we design a system knowing that failure is going to happen, and yet resist the failure. And it's like literally anything can happen, and we have to try to do our best to prevent it from affecting our system. So it's a tough task, and I think that's what makes it fun. So putting it in a little bit more concrete terms, downtime is what we're trying to minimize. We have a service that we provide to users. We want it to be there for users all the time. And so another way of expressing downtime is your failure rate times your recovery time, right? So if you go down 5 times in a month and it takes you an hour to get back up, you were down for 5 hours. The sort of schema that people who work in this industry talk about is the number of nines. How many nines do you have? And so generally people are shooting for something like 5 nines. So that's I am up 99.999% of the time. And then this kind of translates to actual time, which is like I am down for less than 5.26 minutes per year, less than 25 seconds a month. So, and it's each successive nine is, you know, it gets a lot harder really quickly. And you can see once you're down at one or two nines, you've got a lot of wiggle room. So If you aren't running a highly available service, you can take 7 hours of downtime a month and still say you're 99% available. So that's a little bit of an ego boost. One of the things that kind of has shifted in the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years is the focus on where we build resilience in. Basically, it's a different way of thinking about it than it's thought about in sort of industrial applications. When you're thinking about like an object or like an airplane, your mean time to failure has to do with like the stability of the components that you're using. And in technology, we found that you can't really think in the same way. The hardware people do their best to make stable components, but when you're talking about systems as complex and as interconnected as we deal with, your failure rate is just something that you cannot get a handle on. And you can do a much better job of increasing overall downtime by focusing on recovery time. So you'll see that pattern here. So a lot of these patterns involve planning for things to fail. And that's really the first step of kind of approaching high availability, is accepting that failure happens. And once you do that, then you have some things that you can do. I kind of divide these into three categories: anticipate, prepare, and react. So you anticipate a potential failure or a class of failures, and you prepare for that class of failures. You do something to try to mitigate or protect against or recover from more quickly, and then you react. So when the failure happens, or when a failure happens, you determine, did we prepare for it? Is it an expected failure? Is it something that we did not prepare for? And what are we going to do to change? So put another way, and kind of some more concise questions. What could fail? What should we do when it fails? And when it does inevitably fail, what did we learn? So what I've got here is a set of what I'm calling primitives of high availability, which is the, it's a longer term project for me. I'm trying to break down the large tool set that we have to build resilient fault-tolerant systems into, like, composable chunks. So this is sort of an early stage of the project, and also I'm going to show you some of the smaller kind of Lego pieces and how they fit together, and it's something I'm kind of playing around with. So let's see what I got. I start with redundancy, because I think redundancy is the simplest expression of fault tolerance, which is basically, if something's going to fail, have two of them. It's the way that hardware fault tolerance works, which is you keep a closet of spare parts. So your mean time to recovery is going into the closet and getting the spare part and not ordering it from, you know, the vendor. And in technology, though, we can do better than that. We can do better than close-by spare parts. We can actually have it on the next slide. Treat many as one. So we have the ability to have redundancy, but below a layer of abstraction, and only present a single service. So we'll see that in a bunch of different ways here. So as we start to dig into this, there's a common, you ask the question, what fails? So let's think about this. Let's do the project of what fails, and people go like, oh, hardware fails, right? Like software people say hardware fails, and the hardware people say software fails. It's like the classic battle of technology. It turns out, when it comes to servers, when it comes to production web servers, we're actually pretty well covered on hardware components. This is a kind of a perfect example of redundancy in action. So if you take a look at like the modern web server, like a physical web server, you have RAID to cover against disk failure. You have stuff, technology like LACP bonding, which is pretty cool, which is you have two network cables, potentially across two network cards, that are speaking a protocol such that you can snip either cable, and it still goes. And you have, it goes so far as to dual power supplies. So a power supply is something that can fail, then keep two of them around. And so the modern day server is set up such that when components fail, it basically just beeps and sends an email. and that's what you want, because then your mean time to recovery is zero. So because you never went down. So that's cool. The hardware people have kind of got our backs there. So we have to start thinking about things when servers fail. And servers can fail for any number of reasons that are sort of outside the purview of the hardware people. Sometimes it's still hardware fault, but you know, there's network problems, there's power problems, there's all sorts of issues. So we're talking about server redundancy, and that's where the software has to start to consider the fact that we're doing that in order to try to allow the users to treat many as one. And so the core kind of way that we do this with networked components is the transparent proxy. So a transparent proxy is a component, can be software or hardware, that accepts traffic on a single IP address and actually forwards the message on to one of many internal IP addresses, and then gets the response from the backend node, and then responds as though it were the node that did the work. So it's transparent because the client on the left-hand side there doesn't know that it's talking to any one of, like, you know, N servers on the back. And the servers in the backend don't know that they're not talking directly to the client. So in addition to just allowing you to have more than one server, this also presents an opportunity for load balancing. You simply scatter the traffic evenly across the three backend nodes, and you can therefore service more traffic than you could otherwise. So this is actually, like, you'll more often hear them just called load balancers. So when you hear, like, software that is capable of doing transparent proxying, those are sometimes used interchangeably. Like, it's the load balancing component of the software. When you're doing load balancing, you do have to, it does allow you to service more traffic overall than you could with a single node, but you do have to consider the failure in this case, right? So if you lose a single server, each one of your servers has to be able to handle up to half of your traffic. So failure kind of affects the way that you can load balance. So this is cool, I think. How does the load balancer know when to take a server out of rotation? That's it uses a small request that is done periodically. It's called a heartbeat request. So it's, you know, called as such because it's like it has the same cadence as a heartbeat. It happens periodically at a regular interval. It's very short and simple, but it lets you know that you're alive. Most load balancers do this internally. So they're actually doing this request actively to the backends. And if the request times out or errors for any reason, then that backend is balanced out. So cool. Now for our servers, so we've gone up to the server layer and accepted the fact that any server is going to fail, and we can automatically detect when the server fails and just pull it out of rotation. There's actually nothing we have to do. That's pretty amazing. But now we have to deal with something that you deal with a lot in high availability, and that's the single point of failure. So we've got this really cool load balancer out front, and we don't really know. So the single point of failure, it's pretty self-explanatory, sort of like the term. It is a point in your system that if it failed, you would be like, you would have issues. It's the point. So, you know, at the beginning I said, what do you have to do in constructing highly available systems? You have to always ask yourself, what happens if it fails? Single point of failure is the thing where you ask yourself that question and then you go, oh. So the experience of constructing highly available systems is essentially like, well, in a lot of ways, it's the process of just chasing single points of failures out of your system. Like, it's the, you know, they're the bubbles under the sticker that you have to chase out to the edge. Because, like, as soon as you solve one, you've created another one. And, you know, judicious use of your credit card can get them out eventually, which is kind of true. Okay, so we've got a single point of failure here. Let's see what we can do to solve it. So we're going to hop back up to the DNS layer here and take note of the fact that when we asked GitHub what the IP address is for github.com, it didn't respond with a single IP address. It responded with three. And this is an opportunity for some redundancy. So each of these could... I'm not sure how GitHub sets things up, so we're just sort of pretending here. But each of these IP addresses could point directly to a separate load balancer. And then using the heartbeat, so using some sort of heartbeat internal to their system, they could take out one of the load balancers if it starts to misbehave. And they could remove it from DNS, and then subsequent requests for GitHub.com would just not have that IP address. Problem solved. Sort of. So DNS is cool for this, and it's often used for problem solving like this, but it's slow. It's heavily, heavily cached. And it's cached in a way that the person publishing the record doesn't really know, can't fully control how long it is cached. So in this example, so like my browser has like will cache the IP address for 5 minutes. My router will cache the IP address for 15, and then you know they pull the IP address out. It could be you know any like what they say for DNS propagation is you have to wait for 24 to 48 hours, which is a little absurd. Like that's not really always how it works, but that's how bad it gets. So chaos wins this round. Like we can't really use DNS for quick failure. It's used for like longer term maintenance of components, but we have to drop down a layer if we're going to get fast failure, fast recovery on our load balancer. So we bring in another primitive for this, which is clustering. Clustering is incredibly cool and incredibly complicated, but incredibly cool. It's essentially the process by which a group of machines can agree to provide a single service. So I picture the scene from some sort of mobster movie where there's like a gun on the table and there's three thugs sitting around the table and like the boss has told them that they got to kill the guy or whatever. And they're all sitting around the table kind of staring at each other being like, well, one of us has got to do it. One of us has got to do it. And they're all looking at the gun and they're trying to kind of figure it out. That's clustering, except the gun is an IP address and the guys are thugs are actually servers. And they're not like staring at each other quietly. They're actually chattering all the time. So let's say the IP address here is the load balancer IP address that we'd like to be highly available. We've got three servers that could be the load balancer. They could hold that IP address. And essentially what they do is they establish a connection with each other. So they're all connected to each other, and they just constantly talk. They constantly say, I can see him. Can you see him? Can you see him? I can see him. And because it's actually incredibly difficult from a provability standpoint and on an unreliable network to prove that you can't see somebody because they're broken or because you're broken. And that's why in clusters you always see groups of three or five, generally, because there needs to be an agreement between multiple servers that another server is down, such that, because any single server could say, like, oh, everybody else is down. I'm just going to take the IP address. And you can have that happen from multiple sides of the cluster. That's what's called a network partition. So theoretically, if it was a database, you had five servers that could be the database, and suddenly two servers that are like, I'm the main database, then you have problems. So that's what clustering algorithms do. They're super complicated and intriguing, but that's at base what all of them are. So that's things like you'll hear people talk about Paxos and Pacemaker, which is an implementation of Paxos. And then the simpler iteration of Paxos is Raft. And then implementations of Raft include Consul, which is one of the HashiCorp's products. So let's take a look at an example of how this works. So say that we started in a state where the B load balancer had the IP address, and for some reason, B goes down. So A and C now both cannot see B. I should have named them something different. A and C can both cannot see B, and B, C, D, E, F. So what they do is they exchange information with each other really quickly, and they actually hold what's called a leader election. So they both exchange with each other reachability information about, like, I can see you and not him. It's nicer in smaller clusters. It's easier to wrap your head around. And then A says the same thing. I can see you and not him. And then they're like, all right, well, it's got to be one of us, and then they flip a coin. A ends up with the IP address, this process is called failover, and it's usually qualified as automatic failover because there's no human involved. So the process of moving an active service to being served by some other substrate is failover. So the like amazing piece of this that was like a mind-blown moment, the first time I saw, you can do this failover of a load balancer and not drop a single HTTP request. And I didn't really know that this was possible until I got kind of deep into this stuff. But because of the way TCP works, there's a retry mechanism built into TCP. So you can actually perform this failover And what you do is you synchronize the TCP metadata between all three of these servers. So they all have to kind of have metadata about the active connections that are in progress. But once you do that, and there's tools to do it, you can actually fail over from one load balancer to the next and not drop a single request. Like, you'll have like a cluster of requests that take a little bit longer because like a packet had to get retried. But from the user's perspective, absolutely nothing happened. And you just lost an entire machine and like held an election and then elected a new machine and then brought it into service all like within milliseconds. It's so cool. And so that brings in, so that amazingness requires something from the clients. And this is the first kind of primitive of high availability that requires the client has to think about high availability. Generally, it's like in a perfect world, we could just have the client side know nothing, absolutely nothing about the fact that things could fail. And they could just, you know, make the requests and then, you know, go along their merry way. But it's kind of not, it makes it a lot more difficult to be successful. And once you get timeouts and retries, you can kind of push those down to a lower layer in the client such that the user doesn't have to think about them, but you can still have some really interesting behavior. So like TCP, right? So the fact that each TCP packet can get retried and the higher layer, like the blobs of text, can just get stitched together and such that they're just waiting for their blobs of text a little longer. So timeouts and retries are incredibly important. I think that probably like if you're like trying to think in your life more about high availability and about fault tolerance, this is the place where you can get the biggest win. Like writing code day to day, like if you're making a call to an external service, like think about like what happens if this times out? Is this something that's retryable? That's like, there's a big delta for like potentially like much more resilient code there. So when you talk about timeouts and retries, idempotency comes in. So idempotency is the property of an operation such that it can be retried, basically, but such that it can be applied multiple times and it only happens once. So, and again, when you're thinking about timeouts, when you're designing APIs, this can be something that you can offer to your users to help them in case something goes wrong. So let's think about an example here for a second. So if you like think in your head, which one of these is idempotent and which one is not? So, and the answer is actually it depends on both. So you could design the bottom. So the initial thought would probably be the top one's not idempotent because every time you hit increment visit counter, it goes up. So there's no way you can do it multiple times and have the same result. And the bottom one is, because once you delete a user, it's gone. And if you try to delete again, that's fine. However, it's really easy to... let's go to the next slide. So you could switch this around such that you're actually calling record visit instead of increment counter, and you pass some sort of a UUID such that a given visit is only recorded once. So then you're conceptually still incrementing the visitor counter, but you're guaranteed that it only happens once. And you could also screw up the delete user API call and return an error if the user's gone, in such a way that the client has to handle it when they really don't. And so these are the ways that like you have to, thinking about idempotency sets you up for fault tolerance, and sets your clients up for fault tolerance. All right, and now we have to address the elephant in the room. It's a Postgres joke. I love that. You just wait. You're like, you just say the word joke, and then you just stand there and smile. And then eventually people will laugh. It works every time, too. It's a joke. Managing state. Managing state is hard. Very, very hard. So the stuff that we've talked about up until now, redundancy is a little bit easier because you're talking about like stream processing, nodes that do stream processing, basically, and they have very little state. State becomes difficult, so state is stuff like databases, caches, things that have data, stuff that you need to keep. Because that means if anything fails, you can't just be like, oh, well, let's use another one. You have to make sure that anything it was responsible for carrying is elsewhere. And so there's a theorem that sort of covers the various trade-offs in managing state in a highly available way. It's the CAP theorem. It basically means consistency, availability, partition tolerance, pick two. So we're going to go. We're not going to go super deep into the CAP theorem. I highly recommend, if you're interested in this stuff, to go to the Chicago DevOps meeting this month. Kyle Kingsbury is in Chicago, and he does amazing work on data stores and figuring out their actual properties. He wrote this thing called Jepsen, which is based on Carly Rae Jepsen, Call Me Maybe. So he basically takes data stores and he breaks them in incredibly interesting ways and makes graphs out of it. If you're not familiar with it, you should look it up. Look up Jepsen and understand how all of the data stores that you think are reliable are not. And consider going to his talks, which are regularly, and I think this month he's talking at Chicago DevOps. So what do you do in a more, you know, like talking about primitives here? What do you do with data? You replicate it. You copy it to more than one place, such that if you lose it in any one place, you got it somewhere else. So replication is how we establish redundancy in state. Replication can have two flavors. You can have synchronous replication, and synchronous replication means that you're guaranteeing that the data is in more than one place before you acknowledge the fact that you've written it. And you can have asynchronous replication, where you're lagging behind the actual writes happening to what's called the primary or the master, with the obvious trade-offs there. Synchronous is slower but more reliable. Asynchronous is faster, but you could lose some data. So it sort of depends on the shape of your data. And then what you do, once you add replication on, you sort of layer on top all of some of these other primitives. And this is where you can kind of start to see the composability of these. So you commonly see clustering in database applications because you need to have a service represented by only one. There has to be a primary. Well, in kind of traditional relational databases, there does. And then, you know, you can use automatic failover. You can start to use load balancing of reads. You can start to fan out the reads such that all the reads don't hit one node. So there's a lot more detail there, but that's sort of the basics of how you deal with state. But I do want to get to spend a couple minutes on monitoring. So monitoring is an incredibly large topic. So these last two have been like kind of, you know, quick overviews of large topics on which there are conferences dedicated to them. But monitoring is massive and obviously really important for all of the steps of dealing with high availability and fault tolerance. You need to know what to look at. You need to figure out stand up the services to watch it. You need to know when things fail, and then you need to be able to react. So I'm going to sort of congeal the monitoring stuff into just a couple of points. The first one is know your limits. So there are some limits that you can, or there are limitations on resources that you can track and prevent yourself from some really, really embarrassing downtime. And there are basic ones for computers. It's disk space, it's memory, and then it's CPU. Disk space and memory are really obvious. They fill up. CPU and I/O, you can start to see too much load. Similarly with network bandwidth, fills up. Entropy is actually a really fun one, especially if you work in a virtualized environment. I didn't know this when I started down this whole HA path, but entropy is like a resource that can be used up. Like a Linux computer maintains a pool of entropy that it uses for pseudo-random number generation, and it goes down. And what happens is in a hardware machine, it uses hardware sampling collect random data. There's actually like devices you can buy that like sample FM like static in order to like get random data. But in virtualized environments, oftentimes like it's spread out amongst like a bunch of VMs, and you can get to the point where like you've built a SSH key generation somewhere deep into your system, and like it just locks. Like it says like I'm going to generate an SSH key, and then it pauses for like 15 minutes, and you have no idea why, and everything locks up. So, but that's something you can graph. You can like watch the entropy pool and just like send an email. It's like, hey, the entropy pool is kind of low here, and it's crazy. So like that's a weirder one, right? That's probably one that you would discover. But there are obvious ones, and the biggest one is disk space. I'd say the most common. I will posit that the most common cause of downtime is a disk filling up. And if you're graphing, if you're alerting on disk space, you will avoid the 80% case of random downtime of things on the internet. So monitoring needs to be part of the React plan. So that needs to be the question you ask yourself when things go wrong. If you didn't anticipate them, if your monitoring didn't catch it, how will we catch it in the future? How would we have known that this was going to happen? Or how would we have known that this is exactly what happened faster? That's how you continuously improve your monitoring. And, you know, then that in terms of the mechanisms for how you do it, that's where you start to dig into the amazing, crazy amount of information that there is on monitoring. It's a big field that's moving fast, which is good because it sucked for a while, and now it's getting a lot better, a lot faster. All right, so let's kind of pull this up into things to remember. As individuals working on technology, it's really important for us to be able to ask ourselves the question on a constant basis, what happens when it fails? So you're making an API call, you're storing some information in a cache, you're making a large database query, a small database query, what happens when it fails? Keep that in mind, not all the time, but regularly. You will catch things. You will make your systems better. You will save the day by simply considering it and asking the question. And then the second place I think you should really kind of bring this up is when you're choosing technology. What is the high availability story for the tech that you're considering? You can be the person who asks that question, and when you're doing technology decisions and it's always a really important question to ask because there are trade-offs in everything that we choose. And then I did want to make one more sort of like wistful, like pointing to the future that someday I do think we will raise the layers of abstraction over these topics such that like web developers, people writing code on a day-to-day basis have to think about it less. And the primitives that I'm sort of teaching to you here will need to be less prevalent in the sort of minds of everybody. And that's the HashiCorp logos in the background, because I think that's kind of the future that we're working towards is, you know, building the tooling such that we can establish a clean layer of abstraction over this stuff and automate it. But until then, we've gained ourselves a little bit of a toolbox in order to fight against the big bad chaos. And kind of using these tools together and sort of thinking about these things, we can really make progress. We can feel a little less small next to chaos. And to the list of like actual concrete things, I would add the kind of human quality of perseverance. I think that's the thing that really will allow us to win, is to continually in a Chumbawamba like fashion, learn from failure. We suck at things, we fail, and then we learn. And that's how we get better. And it's, you know, how it's worked forever, and it's how it works in these crazy high availability systems. So, thanks a lot. And I got some time for questions if you want to chat.
In your clustering slide, you showed three load balancers pointing to probably three backend hosts. Are those three, can they be the same three for each load balancer, or do you need, for example, nine backend servers per?
More is always better, but so it could be either way. So the question is, when you have a cluster of three load balancers, and you know, I showed a load balancer with three backend hosts. Do you need nine backend hosts then for your three load balancers? And I was like, the answer directly to your question is no. Generally, what you do is each load balancer has the same three backend hosts. If you're really paranoid, you can have each. And some people will do something where you have three load balancers and each does have three backend hosts, and then each of those load balancers fanned out via DNS. But generally, no. It's you don't necessarily have to multiply out your arity. Answered.
So, if you don't mind saying, what are you working on that's going to address those things? Like, I'm familiar with Vagrant and Packer and Vault, and which is new, but like, what other would address these types of things?
Sure. So the question is, am I working on that will address these sorts of things? Which is like, fix this for us. It's not what you meant, but I understand. So my baby is Terraform, and that is infrastructure orchestration. And so basically it's like a configuration language for establishing these patterns in a way that can be automatically spun up and connected together in cloud environments. And so I hope, like, so this is, like I said, this is kind of a longer-term project for me, but I hope that what I'd like to do is make these primitives concrete in Terraform modules. So a Terraform module is just a set of config that can be that's pluggable. I'm picturing a day in which, like, I could take the load balancer model, right? And I could say, like, if you did this in Google Cloud, it would look like this. If you did this in AWS, it would look like this. If you did this in, a VMware-based hardware environment, it would look like this. And so that's the tooling. That's the area that I'm doing, like, concrete work in this. It's, like, templating the massive, like, complexity and interconnectedness of the cloud APIs into something that's consistent and reproducible.
I'm having trouble understanding the cluster thing. How do you get an IP address to point? Like, is that not just moving the single point of failure back?
Yeah. The question here is, wait, I have a thing here. When you're clustering, does that not just move the single point of failure up to the IP address? Which is a good question.
Or, like, doesn't the IP address have to map to some single point of entry to these three in the cluster? I don't understand how one can just volunteer to take over an IP address without it, like, reporting to some central command.
So, yeah. So the question, like, so he doesn't understand how a single IP address can move, right? Like, how can an IP address move between two services? And this is, so the protocol by which IP addresses are assigned and declared is ARP. I forget the name of it. Something, something, something. Three letters. I'm going to say it's three words. I'm just going to guess.
Something routing protocol.
Something routing protocol. Yeah, that's good. we know stuff collectively. So what happens in the way IP addresses work, right? There's the DHCP model, which is you show up on the network and you say, give me an IP. And there is an authority that says, here is your IP. And it's actually got a table of IP addresses. There's also the static model, where you show up on the network and you declare your IP to the world, provided it's in the correct bounding of, like, the way the network is connected. That's a perfectly valid model. And so what you do is, it's something called the gratuitous ARP. So it's built into the protocol that one can broadcast, like, hello, I have this IP address. And it's actually a way that people can do mischief, right? Somebody can say, like, I have this IP address when you're actually an attacker. But you do it in a closed network. So you turn on the ability for people to listen to gratuitous ARPs, and A here decided to take the IP address over, and it basically starts spamming the network with, like, I'm this IP address right now. It's me. Please send all packets destined for this IP address to me now. And so it's more of a peer-to-peer protocol thing. And so the IP address itself, and like I said, with retries, you kind of, like, you hide behind the TCP retry limit. So you are doing stuff, right? There's a point at which nothing is responding to the IP address, but the idea is it's very tight and it's between retries. So it's effectively zero downtime.
Just to follow up, what would B and C's IP address be so that the three of them could talk to each other if A is declared?
They would have so the question is, what would B and C's IP address be? Foo and bar and buzz, I should have... generally, you have multiple network interfaces. So they each have an internal network interface that they're using for their clustering algorithm, and there's an additional external network interface that's either got the IP address or doesn't.
So you said it's usually three or five?
Mm-hmm.
Four?
You can have... So the why three or five and not four? You can have four. I know. Quorum. You need to have quorum. That's it. You need it's easier to have a simple majority.
And
so you can do seven.
And in that case, in the case of more than three, are they all connected to each other, or is it still a parameter?
Generally, that's not accurate. Yes, they are all connected to each other.
So if there were a fourth one, it would then have...
It would be, it's called mesh networking, full mesh.
Gotcha.
Yeah. which though in reality ends up looking like they're all connected to a switch, that it has them on the same VLAN. It's not like actual cables going between computers.
I think whenever I'm thinking about like what could possibly fail, like, especially like earlier in the project, like when it's a new system, like you don't quite know like what different ways or plugins could fail. Like the harder question is like when it does fail, like what is the information that I want at hand, so I get to start the log with that. Do you have, like, strategies on, like, how you go about doing that?
Or you just, like, yeah, so earlier on in a project, it's harder to be able to predict what's going to fail and what clever ways it's going to fail, I think you said. And so what can you do when you don't know the ways it's going to fail up front? Are there any strategies you can use? Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I think, like, I'll try and, like, future versions, I'm going to keep like iterating on this talk. But logging is key. So like, what can you do such that you have the correct information? The worst thing in a highly available system is a failure that you know the information exists to diagnose, but you didn't write it down. This actually just happened to me in a system I was working on where we got this massive, massive traffic spike for this one single path on the server. And it was for a 700 megabyte file, and it was being requested over 150 simultaneously parallel requests every 5 minutes. So it was like nothing, nothing, nothing. And it was really hard to diagnose, first of all, because it was bandwidth limitation. So it was actually like, it's only 150 requests, which in a web server is not that bad, but because they were just like sucking down a file, they were choking the outbound internet. And so what it looked like was all the graphs that we had just started going up. Like all the latency graphs. It's like, oh, slower database, slower cache, slower everything. What the hell? So it was a subsystem that did not have good logging, and so we could see that it was the same path being requested, but we weren't logging the remote IP. And so we had to like sit there under this like onslaught of crazy traffic that we knew we had a feeling was from just a couple of IP addresses. While we like frantically wrote the code to redeploy the service such that we could like. You just get the damn IP addresses and put them in the firewall. Because once you put them in the firewall, it's like the traffic goes away. Both IP addresses turned out to be in China. I don't want to say anything bad about China, but simply reporting the facts. So here's what you, like, there. Yeah, I wish I could, like, enumerate them, like, with some authority. But at very least, log stuff. Anything that you think might be useful, log it. Over, like, make your logs verbose first. And then filter stuff out. Really, it's really helpful to make sure that every request, if you're in a request response system, that each request has a unique identifier. That's a common mistake where like you just like the default logging just does like timestamp and like you know five lines. And once you're like interleaving 30 processes doing that, and you cannot stitch back together a single request. So like unique UUID on requests, remote IPs is good. I mean, and yeah, save more earlier. Aggregate your logs, which is really hard because it's like everything by default will write to disk, right? And like it's an operational like annoyance. And once you're in a more mature company, there's just going to be a solution handed to you for log aggregation. In other words, like getting the lines that you write to logs to a central place that's like searchable and like won't just fill up the disk locally. But once you have more than one server, like you're going to be really hard pressed to solve a problem when you're like pulling the logs from three web servers and like smushing them together and then like finding a timestamp and all that stuff. And then I guess the last thing I'll say about logging is get good at grep and awk. Those are the tools. Those are the tools that allow me to do diagnosis really fast. And because they're installed on remote machines, like you can very like once you get the idea of like. Oh, like timestamps are in a consistent format. If I want to see 1 hour worth of traffic, I can actually just do like you know, search for JUN space four, like 1/12 June 1/2 June 12 space 04. Oh, that's all the traffic for that hour, and then you know you can narrow it down, and then you're starting to like you do like a sort dash U or something like that, or a unique dash C. That's a really good one, where it's like take all unique lines and smoosh them together and tell me how many there were. So you combine these tools together, and you can like really quickly like come back to the chat room where you're like, hey, in this hour we got like 100 million requests of this type. So, a couple of things.
Envision these primitives becoming something you don't aren't generally concerned
about. Yeah, I'm obsoleting myself before I even start. Yeah.
And so it's sort of like the level of this stuff you talked about earlier on, TCP and you know, BGP, things we don't think about every day. We develop their applications. What do you envision the next set of primitives or problems beyond that, once we don't have to worry about high availability of data?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, I'm talking about these primitives that I hope someday you won't have to worry about. and, you know, you were talking about TCP and BGP, the fact that, like, we don't have to know about that at all, like, to be able to do our jobs. And so what are going to be the next things that we don't have to worry about? What you see in, like, the crazy hot space of containerization, which is just, like, the VM thing all over again. There's, like, hardware, and then it's, like, oh, we can virtualize the hardware. And now it's like, oh, we can put containers on the virtualized hardware. But I think what we're getting to, like the big sort of next step is, they call it data center as a computer. Here's another thing you really don't think about is process scheduling. Like almost nobody has to think about process scheduling on a single machine. There's all these processes sharing CPU time on the machine. There's all this code that does it, but a very relatively small subset of like developers have to think about that. We're going to get to a point where that model of like time sharing is applied to apps running in a data center. So you can say like as we're moving towards like service oriented more microservice stuff, which you know we can talk about the benefits of and detriments of that. But I think we're going to get to the point where you don't care where your service runs. You simply declare the sort of resources it needs. Whereas like I need a SQL database and I need you know, constraints, right? So it's like, I need to be able to respond within 50 milliseconds during business hours. And you just hand it off. And it's the data center's responsibility in an automated fashion to make sure you're scaled properly to be able to do that. And I need weekly backups and point in time backups for the last 5 hours, stuff like that. So it'll be interesting. Of course, there will always be like people like me who get like geekily obsessed with the arcana, but I'm also super dedicated to like establishing clean cut breakpoints. I think that it's an interesting project overall, which is we have all this really complicated technology, and like constructing it in such a way that not everybody has to understand all of it, because there's definitely like I don't understand compilers, I don't understand process schedulers, I want to be able to support people who don't want to understand like fault tolerance and high availability. So, all right, time for one more.
So the more that you horizontally scale your server architecture, does that make dealing with race conditions a lot more difficult?
So the question is, if as you horizontally scale more, do you end up having to deal with race conditions more? The nature of distributed systems sort of births a whole new class of problems. That's going to be the... I feel like that's sort of the next layer of failure. So these deal with simple failure, but, like, they're really interesting failure scenarios, failure modes, they sometimes call them. And one of them is a race condition, where you have, like, multiple services that are doing the same work very close together. There's really, like, I'm still learning about stuff like back pressure, which is, like, if you have a system that's, like, accepting traffic and you're pushing too much load onto, like, some sort of back end, like, that's weaker, you can actually, like, intentionally start to throttle the upstream. That's where you see, like, API throttling limits. Like, that's the simple case of that. But, yeah, so there's a whole class of distributed system-specific problems that require solutions and... some of the solutions have patterns, and I'll figure out what those are, and I'll add them. All right. Thanks so much, everybody. Thank you. Oh, thanks. I'll take it. I don't know. He's around a lot. He's around a lot enough that I thought he was living here, so maybe he's not. Hey, man. Specifying like just requirements. Yeah, I mean that's the idea. Yeah, yeah. I mean they're called container schedules, right? Like, so it's just like a process that works. But it's really cool. Yeah, great to see you.
Sorry.
Well, I want to introduce you to Angela.
Hi, Angela.
I think we're
going
to be more.
Oh, cool.
Really, really, really good talk. I was curious because like.